A podcast of the cinema. You are Dave White, and I'm Alonzo Duralde, and
we're film critics.
Yes,
you are the film reviews editor of The Wrap. You yes. are the star.
No,
you are a star of What the Flick, along with your three other co-stars.
If that's how you want to do it,
whose
sure.
names I just can't remember right now.
On the Young Turks Network on YouTube.
On the Young Turks Network, where you did not intentionally ignore whatever that movie was about the Armenian genocide. What's it called? The Promise?
The Promise, yeah. I think only
that
one
everybody
of us
says
it.
Is super boring, but now people are on your butt about you guys not having reviewed it because it's about the Armenian genocide.
Right, like it's this grand conspiracy. No, it's just a...
Didn't y'all review the Russell Crowe movie?
I don't remember.
I know you did. You must have.
I never saw it, so I don't remember.
That was a snooze, too. And that movie ignored the Armenian genocide.
Yeah. Believe me, there is no grand conspiracy afoot. It's just that I think only Christy has seen it, and I have not been revved up to go because every review I've read of The Promise says it's a big snooze. So that's why we haven't talked about it yet on The Young Turks. And we are married to each other, and we are film critics. So, yeah, welcome, if this is your first time.
Welcome, welcome.
Welcome, welcome. I got to be...
Now get out.
I was on PBS NewsHour this week.
Talking, oh, yeah, you talk, do. Yeah, big,
talking
you,
about summer
you
movies.
Were, you were fancy this week.
I was very fancy.
Not only did you go to the USA Film Festival in Dallas, which you always do because you're a former... What did you used to do for them?
Artistic director.
That's right.
I'm their emeritus.
When I met you, you were the artistic director of that film festival.
Correct.
And that is how we met.
I mean, because I was living there.
Yeah,
yes.
Because you were living there, and you had moved here. You had moved to Dallas from Los Angeles.
Right.
And I ran into you.
It was a good festival
like
this year.
Like a bull.
It's always a fun festival. I got sick this year, which kind of sucked, but that was not the festival's fault. And
Was it not?
It was not, no. What I did attend of
Are
it...
Are you sure about that?
I am pretty sure, actually. I started thinking that it might have been a buffet, but nobody else was felled by it, and most people had a lot more from it than I did, so... I think it just was something I picked up on the plane.
I'm sorry. Somebody beat you at buffet?
Well, I have gotten...
How is it you don't win at buffet?
I have gotten in the habit from years of working at film festivals.
Yes.
I don't eat at festival parties because people want to...
What is your problem?
Because I'm on the clock. And people want to come talk to you.
I've done so many things on the clock.
And invariably, they want to talk to you when you have just... mashed a giant piece of cilantro into your front teeth.
Yes.
So I just got in the habit.
And that's when you say to them, hold on, I'm eating.
I got in the habit.
And then you go, you wait, I'm chewing the food.
I got in the habit early on to just not eat at those functions. And
that's dumb.
That's why the festival staff would always go out after the reception to go eat in the middle of the night because we were starving from not having eaten at the catered party.
What a terrible job.
It is. It's a lovely job, but that's just one of those things that goes with the territory. You have to just be ready to talk to people, and so I just don't eat at them. So I had a few nibbles late at night, but that was not what got me because nobody else
Look, someone
from that
comes up to you. And someone rolls up on you and is like, question, blah, blah, blah. You go, hey, do you like seafood? Because blah, blah, blah. That's what you do.
Yeah, that's why you don't work in the nonprofit arts. Because you're awful.
Don't hurt my feelings.
But your way is right. I know.
Don't hurt my feelings.
No, you're great. You just...
I have...
You don't maybe have the people skills.
My...
for this
guy. Now you're just digging your own grave. I don't have people skills.
Not if you're going to eat.
I am fully people skilled. Have you know. 100%.
Yes, I know. Actually, you're the dog, I'm the cat.
You weren't hurting my feelings.
Yeah, you're all, I have no feelings.
I ain't got none.
Fine.
So check it out.
Yeah.
So you're back from the USA Film Festival. That's very exciting.
Yes.
It looks like Le Pen is going to be defeated.
Yes.
It looks like.
Okay.
It is as we record, it is 11 a.m.
Pacific time.
Pacific time in California, because that's where Pacific time is.
So it's like, what, 8 o'clock at night?
It's like 8 o'clock-ish at night in France.
Yeah.
And they're saying it's about 2-1.
Awesome.
What's the guy's name? Macron?
Macron.
That's what I'll call him from now on. I'll think of him as something sweet. And it looks like he's going to beat her.
Good.
Which is good.
Yes.
Because seriously.
Yes.
Morrissey. God. So mad at him right now.
Shut up, Euro right wingers.
Shut up, all right wingers. Euro right wingers, American right wingers, shut up, all of you. If you're listening to this podcast, good. That means you're listening to me and you're shutting up. We got movies to tell you about. You'll shut up while we talk about those too, won't you? Yeah, you will, because you're listening.
So there.
Guess I told them.
I guess you did. And to think that I doubted your people skills.
I just told you I got plenty of them. Plenty of people skills.
Ay. All right, where do you want to start?
I would like to start with what I did while you were gone.
Okay.
First of all, if you subscribe to us on Patreon and you listen to Linoleum Knife and Fork, you'll already know the story.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Of how I burned myself with a frying pan while making pancakes naked.
Yes. I would like to think that you learned something from this, but I bet you didn't.
Look how great my scar is.
It's scabbing up nice.
It's crazy looking.
Yeah.
It's been over a week. It still really hurts.
Mm-hmm. It's still quite red. I would like to think that you have learned that you should not make pancakes naked, but something tells me you'll just do it again. Am I wrong?
Summer's coming. I mean, it's pretty cold today. It's kind of a chilly day in Los Angeles.
It's a chilly day in Los Angeles.
Boy.
Birds in the 50s.
It is, yeah. Summer's coming. And you know what that means in this house.
Naked pancakes?
Windows open, fans going, ceiling fans going.
Yeah.
I'm not wearing a lot of clothing.
Fine, but just wear. Put the apron on.
I might.
You need some coverage for scorching hot objects.
That's true. But I'm so cute.
I know. Believe me.
I'm so adorable. I'm so fat.
I hate to be the one.
And attractive.
I hate to be the one to be throwing clothes onto you and all, but I think when cooking, it's a good idea.
Anyway, the important cinema thing I did while you were gone, I got to go see Lost City of Z or Z?
Well, the British like to say Z.
Listen, it's the letter Z.
Yes.
And unless you're British, or is it Canadian too? Canadians also say Z, don't they?
The Canadians do a lot of British-y things.
I think pretty much anybody who's not a United Statesian says Z. Am I wrong?
Maybe.
Okay, well.
Get nothing but static on Channel Z.
They call this film, they've called the place in the movie Z. So officially, I guess, technically, it is known, the film is known as Lost City of Zed.
Right.
But it's the letter Z, and we say Z, so I say Lost City of Z.
Okay.
I saw it. Oh, God, I love it so much.
Okay, tell me why, because I...
Oh, you want a film critic reason?
Just anything, because I really was not super into it, but I want to hear your reasons.
I want to know what, remind me again why you weren't, in your words, super into it.
No, I want to hear yours first. No, you go. I asked you first.
Well, we can recap a little bit about
what it's about.
What it is, it's based on a nonfiction book, The Lost City of Z. True story, British explorer named Percy Fawcett.
Yes.
Which to us now today seems like a funny sounding name, but that was his name.
The turn of the 20th century, and this is a new movie from James Gray, who did The Immigrant, is that what it's called?
The Immigrants.
The Immigrant and...
The Lovers.
No, two Lovers.
Sorry, Two Lovers.
And The Yards.
Yeah. Percy Fawcett is played by Charlie Hunnam.
Mm-hmm.
And he needs his position in society a little more cemented. Yes. He had a dissolute father,
somebody
who
in the film
has wrecked the family name, and that back then was everything. If you were
British,
wanting to have any sort of future in society,
somebody in the film refers to him as having had an unfortunate choice of ancestors.
Yes, yes, and so. The Geographic Society, he petitions them.
No, they come to him.
I'm sorry, they come to him.
To settle a border dispute between, Brazil and Bolivia or something?
I think so.
Because of gold mining.
And he goes to the Amazon and finds evidence of a civilization, a city, with technological advances equal or perhaps even surpassing England, and perhaps even older.
Yeah, well, yeah, a civilization that predates Western civilization. Yeah.
And he finds pieces of pottery.
Right.
And so, and the he goes home, he tells everybody about it, and they're like, no, you didn't find that.
Fish and tosh.
Because the reason you didn't find that is because everybody knows.
The world didn't get civilized until white people did it.
Until white people did it. And so obviously these, and this is the word they use, savages in right. South America could not possibly be our
equal
intellectual equals. He is ridiculed for this, and he goes back. He takes as his aide-de-camp Robert Pattinson, whose performance I really like.
Yeah, well, he's on the first trip, too.
Right? Yes, yes, he's on all the trips. I love Robert Pattinson's performance in this because he's kind of off to the side and just being a weirdo.
Well, he's that guy that you always see whenever you see, there's the world explorer who is camera ready and does all the talking to the press.
Yeah.
And then there's the guy next to him who
knows things
and knows how to, make food out of tree bark and knows all the knots, but doesn't talk about it, but he's seen things.
And so this is a very nice understated Pattinson performance, this sort of strange man to the side of Charlie Hunnam. Sienna Miller plays his wife.
Mm-hmm. She's quite good in this. And
she very much is.
I often am not super into her stuff.
She
was giving me a big Joanne Wally Kilmer vibe.
Yes, very much so.
Which reminded me, hey, what happened to Joanne Wally Kilmer?
Well, she's no longer married to Val Kilmer.
That much I know.
Starters. I do not know. I assume she does British...
television?
British work.
Yeah. No, she was... In the late 80s, early 90s, she was a big deal, and then kind of went away.
Well, that's what they do to female big deals.
Sadly, yes.
They make them go away. Oh, no, you're 35. Goodbye.
They do it to some guys, too.
They do it to some guys, but the guys get infinite numbers of chances.
They do.
The guys get lots of chances.
Right, but, look, it's not like Skeet Ulrich has had nothing but smooth sailing all the way. He had a moment, and then he went away, and now he's on Riverdale.
He had a moment where they were trying to make him the hot new young thing.
Yes.
And instead he became a character actor.
Right, yeah. But not with the success of, say, Colin Farrell.
Colin Farrell is objectively a better-looking human being.
But it's not about his looks.
Though. That is what it's about at first. That's what they do to you at first.
Yes,
at first
of course.
They say, "Oh, pretty. Let's make them a movie star."
Right, but when you say, "No, I'm going to take door B and be character actor guy,"
right.
Then it's not about being pretty. It's about
your abilities.
Yeah.
And Colin Farrell's a really good actor.
Right.
Okay. So May I continue?
Do.
This has the form of, and here's why I liked it. This has the form of an old-fashioned adventure explorer story.
Yeah, it has some David Lean undercurrents Correct. To it.
It takes that form, but it has a modern sensibility about who we, the Western world, who we were at the turn of the 20th century. And the answer is we were terrible. Shock.
Yeah.
And it also is about, for me, this man's decades-long striving to take care of the things he cared about. He needed to preserve, you know, his family's position. He needed to prove to his peers that he wasn't a crackpot. And he needed the satisfaction of having accomplished these things. And so you feel for him. There's an emotional power in that. You feel for the Sienna Miller character as well. Her loneliness.
He's very devoted to his family, but at the same time is willing to be away from them for very long periods of time.
These are the choices this person had to make.
To go do on these explorations.
The film also takes a very non-exploitive approach to indigenous dignity.
Yes.
And that has not always been the case. In fact, that has been the opposite of the case in lots of the earlier iterations of this of story.
But you can't make this movie where you're criticizing colonization and still like dumb about showing.
So it's a very subtle story about colonization, and then just the beauty of this film. It's just staggering to me. This is the kind of film where you think of the internet every frame a painting, you know, trope that's now, you know, very popular and people talk about. There is so much physically beautiful filmmaking happening here. That I would go see it again, and it's really long, just so I could look at it. And that physically beautiful filmmaking lends it, and I will quote my friend Gary Cotty, who was with me. He said, it has a dreamlike quality. The look of this film gives all the proceedings a dreamlike quality. He said it reminded him of like an old John Borman film.
I mean,
and I agree with him.
I mean, it is gorgeous to look at, I grant you. I tend to be less impressed when you are shooting in an amazing looking part of the earth.
Well, it doesn't matter where you're, if you're shooting something pretty and you don't know what you're doing. No, I know.
But it's like when people went all crazy about the cinematography out of Africa, I'm like, well, yeah, but look at what he's shooting. Like, you would have to be actively inept to not make that look good. I don't know that I agree with the dreamlike quality, because I'm thinking about movies like Aguirre, The Wrath of God, or Fitzcarraldo. Like, that's a dreamlike quality.
I would add those to the same sort of category.
I don't put this up there with those. I liked a lot of it, and I obviously agree with its politics and with its thought about colonization and about, you know, the British Empire and whatever. But I found Charlie Hunnam's performance to be really one note. He always seemed a little constipated to me. Like, it was like he was grunting, like he was straining a little.
No, I felt there was great empathy in his performance.
Okay. And also, because it was a true story and it ends in a sort of enigmatic way, I didn't feel like they figured out a way to remain true to what we know and what we don't know happened and make it a satisfactory climax for the film. You know what I'm saying? Like they had no choice but to work with what actually happened because of you know, because it's a true story.
Right.
But there are ways of telling or ways of portraying or you know, choices that a writer and a director make that can overcome that. And I didn't feel like it did. I mean, it kind of petered out for me. But I do agree there is a lushness to it, and I, you know, I was thinking about David Lean, especially the score is very sort of old fashioned kind of orchestral,
yeah,
you know, grandeur,
yes,
which was beautifully done. There's a lot I like about this film, and I certainly like it way more than Two Lovers, which is a movie that everybody in the world but you and me loves for some reason.
I guess I need to go back and watch Two Lovers again.
I just bored the snot out of me, yeah. And this one I did kind of. I had to sort of fight my head from bobbing, you know.
Listen, this is how much I loved it. I saw this middle of the afternoon on a Saturday. Uh-huh. Y'all, that's nap time. Seriously. I mean, every day in the middle of the day is nap time, but...
Especially Saturday.
Ooh, especially a Saturday afternoon. And I was on it.
Yeah, I...
No dozing.
I kind of... There were moments that I had to sort of fight to stay in it. We should mention Tom Holland, our new Spider-Man, who is his son, who joins him on the final expedition once he sort of comes into adulthood. And he's fine. He's not in it all that much. No, there are things I like about it, but overall, I'm not super...
Who's the other British actor with a name that sounds just like his?
Tom Hollander.
Seriously?
Yeah.
We've got Tom Hollander and Tom Holland.
Yes. They're about 20, 30 years apart.
I know they are in age, but they're going to have to fight.
Well, you know, I'm still waiting for somebody to cast Jeremy Renner and Jeremy Renier in the same movie.
That would be great, because yeah. Not only could they play brothers.
Totally.
And convincingly.
Yeah.
Just brothers that were raised in different countries, since one is French or Belgian.
Right.
But yeah, it's funny because Jeremy Renier never really works in English language film.
Yeah.
No one confuses them.
No, it's only
but
film.
You and I, and I are the ones who talk about this all the time.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Let's skip the documentary Obit for this week.
Okay.
Because you've seen it and I have not yet seen it.
If you're dying to find out my thoughts, go over to What the Flick on YouTube. Christy and I reviewed it this week.
But I do want to talk about the documentary Burden really quickly.
Which you saw and I did not.
I reviewed it for the Wrap.
And it is streaming, so if you're in the United States, you can get it on iTunes or any of the usual places.
If you live in Los Angeles, if you have ever visited Los Angeles in the past 10 years or so...
If you have friends who have visited Los Angeles and put pictures on Facebook...
Or Instagram, and if you have ever seen a film in the past 10 years set in Los Angeles, you have seen Urban Lights. Or rather, is it Urban Lights or Urban Light? It's...
You would know.
Yeah. Okay, well, whatever it is.
You've seen those street lamps outside of the LA County Museum of Art.
Yes. And those were made... I'm sorry, light. Urban Light, not lights. Forgive me, memory of Chris Burden. 202 vintage cast iron street lamps taken from the scrap heap.
Yeah.
But that had once sort of...
Served a purpose.
Been on streets in Southern California lighting them. This was the 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
The artist Chris Burden, he collected those and he turned it into everybody's favorite thing.
Yeah, one of the most beloved pieces of public art in the world.
In this city at least. And it's become a symbol of Los Angeles as... It's going to rival the Hollywood sign pretty soon.
No, it's a definite visual shorthand that people associate with us now.
And that was from the artist Chris Burden. Now, you wouldn't think something that warm and fuzzy, something that lovely, that has a companion inside the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, a sculpture, a kinetic installation called Metropolis 2, which consists of 1,100 toy cars, like little matchbox cars, speeding around
an elaborate urban landscape.
Elaborately built city made of like erector set and blocks and train tracks and you name it. these cars, every hour, well, no, they're on an hour, off an hour, on an hour, off an hour, so that the machinery doesn't overheat and burn out.
Right.
But for 1 hour, you get to stand there and watch this spectacular thing.
It's hypnotic.
Everybody loves it, children to old people.
Yeah.
That's also from Chris Burden. In the early 70s, Chris Burden was I would call him proto-punk rock.
Okay, that's fair.
Because he certainly had the look.
Yeah.
Real buzzed up short hair.
And the aesthetic, for sure.
The aesthetic of, like, I might rob you. That look, that sort of nervy, I might be, like, jacked up on some kind of speed and...
My art is dangerous.
Well, literally dangerous.
Yeah.
He's the man who in 1971 got another man to shoot him in the arm with a rifle as a sculpture.
Yeah.
And he described...
In an art gallery.
The sculpture was the moment the bullet hit his arm. That is the sculpture. Everything after that is everything after that.
Is now, critique.
He kind of began... He was a West Coast pioneer of performance, you know. The Fluxus people before that, they did some performative stuff. Obviously, people in New York were also getting on that train. Laurie Anderson, probably the most famous of them. But Chris Burden was really doing his own thing, and he was putting his body on the line. When he was still in college, his very first performance was called 5 Day Locker. He folded himself up into a very tiny locker at the school and stayed there for 5 days.
Was there like...
There was.
That wasn't what I was going to ask.
You don't immediately think of poop and pee? Because that's what I think of.
No, I was going to ask, was there like some sort of camera inside or anything like that? So there's just a closed locker and he was in it.
And people would come up and say, hey, are you in there? And he'd be like, yep.
So he was like Schrodinger's Chris Burden.
My thoughts, the durational element of his performances, always the first thing I think of is, when do you pee?
Right.
Like, who are you allowed to pee? And can you get up? Does it break? Does it end the performance if you get up to pee? Is there a bucket? A bag? I need to know.
These seem like catheter-based installations.
Yes. He did one where he was lying down on the floor with electrical bands over his arms and his neck,
mm-hmm.
and a bucket of water next to him. And he was plugged in. Ready to go. And that was the performance. That was the sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
Viewers, if one person had chosen
mm-hmm.
to take that bucket of water and knock it over, he'd have died.
Yeah.
He was literally daring viewers to electrocute him.
This sounds like the, what was the Experimenter movie about?
What are you talking about?
The thing where people thought they were pressing the button.
Yeah. The film Experimenter, when they thought they were actually giving people shocks.
Yeah, it's an actual thing that happened in the 60s.
Well, he
took it to the next level.
He took it to the next level. He's the guy who had himself crucified to the back of a Volkswagen Beetle.
Mm.
Nails hammered through his hands into the car. So that was him. Back in the day.
He was also the street lamps guy.
That was him early on in his life.
Right.
The 70s were a wild time for Chris Burden.
So the documentary
takes you more or less chronologically through his career and his work and his mm-hmm. life. And it's mostly focused on the work. It is less focused on his personal life, even though that does come up. There's a lot of information that you don't get a full picture of about his relationships, because he had them and they were troubled.
Mm.
you hear from one of his wives, but she doesn't appear on camera. You hear her voiceover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm kind of getting Bad Boyfriend from some of these installations.
I'm yeah, you get the feeling that he was not a great guy to be in a relationship with in the 70s. But then you also see him interspersed through this chronology, being a 60-something man living in Topanga Canyon, very peacefully, very quietly, very remote, about half a dozen assistants helping him work on various things. Mm. And he has mellowed, but is no less enigmatic and no less difficult when it comes to discussing himself or his work. Mm-hmm. Lots of artists, and one of the things I find very interesting about artists in documentaries, and I'm thinking specifically about an artist whose work I own, Chris Johansson. Mm-hmm. He is interviewed in the documentary Beautiful Losers.
Yeah.
And I love Chris Johansson's work. I'm a gigantic fan of his work. You like his work, and you don't like most of the art that I bring into the house.
It's true.
I remember watching Beautiful Losers, and Chris Johansson's interview segments were, as I sat there watching it, I thought, you do not like to talk about yourself or your work or anything. You don't like to explain it. You don't like to talk about it. Mm-hmm. You give circle answers.
Right.
You give these oblique answers about other topics. I've met him, actually. And he's charming and very kind. But, man, you put him in a camera in front of him and say, explain your work. And he's like, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. So that's... I think that's... every time I see an art documentary and they are trying to get the artist to explain themselves, that's not why you watch an art documentary. You watch an art documentary for a sense of history, for a sense of their place in the art world or in the world in general. You watch it for the feeling. It's a way for you to learn about someone maybe that you don't know. Mm-hmm. It's a way for you to get a sense of whether or not you want to learn more or see more of this artist's work.
I think there are also art documentaries can be valuable about context.
Yeah.
Like, here's what's happening in the culture. Here's what he's responding to. Here's a movement he was part of. Here's why people didn't like him then but love him now. Yes. Like, you know, that sort of thing is what I usually
learn. The art world, they loved him back in the day. They've never not loved him. But this was, you know, decades before the internet. And so there's this beautiful, wonderful clip in the film of him going on Philbin and Company. Christmas Eve, 1975.
With Reege.
Regis Philbin interviewing him and saying, so why did you get yourself shot?
Mm-hmm. I don't, you're in the gallery, there's a rifle.
And Burton says, it seemed like the best thing I could do at the time. And that's why I did it. And Regis Philbin was like, and that's a sculpture? And what you hear from Burton earlier in the film is his ideas about sculpture. Mm-hmm. And the blur between sculpture and performance for him.
Yeah.
He says, you look at a painting on the wall, and you're there, you're seeing it from one position, and you move on.
Right.
He said, a sculpture requires action. It's three-dimensional. You walk around it. You look at it from different angles. Mm. You are participating in that piece of art because you are moving. And so he decided that as sculpture, he would move himself.
Well, what about what if you make a very big painting? You have to move to see the
Why don't you go ask Chris Burden that question?
He's dead, or I would.
He died in 2015 of cancer. And I there is such a gentle quality to this documentary, such a lovely picture of a person moving through life, mm-hmm. and their work moving with them. And and what that man becomes and what the work becomes.
And they interview Pulitzer Prize winning food writer Jonathan Gold.
Yes, he's also in it. He was Burton's assistant, I learned, in the 80s.
Fascinating.
It's funny the things you learn about people you actually know in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And that just never had come up.
Well, you know, given that I'm staring down a big birthday right now, it has occurred to me how, like, people I know who are older, who I've known for, you know, decades even, but I've known them at this point in their life doing this thing that they do.
Yes.
And then at some point or other, something will pop out that you find out this previous job they had or this previous life they had. Like, wait, what?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. And I figure, I guess that's probably the same people that know me maybe don't know every step of all the
gotten to the place in my life where people don't know until I tell them and are quite sometimes often surprised that I was a middle school teacher in Texas.
Right, yeah.
For 8 years.
Yeah, when I met you, that's what you were.
And they have to rearrange me in their head a little bit.
Yes.
So I really like this documentary. Yeah, again, it's streaming. You should see it.
Yeah.
And the end.
Okay.
What else we got?
We got the superhero movie and the trans.
Let's get three generations out of the way. Okay. Is it worth talking about even all that much?
I think we need to address it, you know, just for the record.
So go on.
Okay, this is a movie that's been knocking around for a while. It premiered at the 2015 Toronto Film Festival under the title About Ray. It's now called Three Generations. It stars Elle Fanning as a trans male teen named Ray, who is 16 and ready to start taking testosterone.
Has been begging for it.
Yes. Yeah, like he's finally getting to...
Not just in his mind, you know, okay, now I'm finally ready, has wanted to do this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think is now finally sort of, I guess, medically allowed. I don't know how that works.
No. He could have done it earlier.
Oh, okay.
I watch I Am Jazz.
No, I know that, but this movie...
This movie's
been around so long, I don't even know if when they made it, it was different then. If
Jazz started
About
puberty blockers.
Yes, I'm aware of all. I watch I Am Jazz with you, you may recall, and I've probably seen more trans documentaries than you have.
That's fine.
So,
yes.
Back off.
All right.
Anyway.
You win. Keep talking.
Ray is 16 and ready to start taking testosterone. That requires a parental consent form because Ray is... a minor. Ray's mom, played by Naomi Watts, is, you know, seemingly on board, but still apparently still kind of reticent and unsure. And
She's had 12 years.
Yeah, Ray says he's known since he was 4 that he was a boy. I'm not sure when Ray started telling his mother that, but...
She talks about it.
Oh, okay.
Naomi Watts' character talks about it. She says, tomboy. And
never wanted to wear dresses.
Blah, blah. Yeah.
I remember that.
But she knew.
Fine. And then Ray's grandmother, who is played by Susan Sarandon, who has a longtime female companion, you know, can't understand why Ray can't just be like a butch dyke, basically. And most of the movie winds up being about getting the form signed. Will Naomi Watts sign it? Will they go find Ray's dad? And will Ray's dad sign it? Signing the form. The form needs to be signed. We have to sign the form. Form, sign, sign, form, sign. Ah. That's all the movie is about. It's like, there's a story here about a trans teen, if anybody wants to talk about that. But no, please, the paperwork is far more interesting.
There's a moment. There came a moment in the film where all I could think of was Timothy Hutton in Ordinary People yelling, "Just give her the goddamn camera!
Just sign the dang form!"
I sat there in the screening room with you, and I turned to you, and I said, "Will somebody please sign these forms?"
Now, look, yes, there is a story to be told about families of trans individuals and dealing with that and wrapping their head around that change and all that stuff.
Yes.
But this movie
is scared of its own shadow.
It is so timid, and it exists in this bubble that I don't believe exists, because yes, I understand that everybody comes to it at a different time, and they have their own pace in figuring things
out.
But we are showing these characters who are like New York City.
They live in Brooklyn. They're bohemians. Yeah. They're art people. You know, sophisticated.
Susan Brandon's been a lesbian for decades, and she ran a jazz club.
Right.
And it's like, no, you know, Naomi Watts is an artist and an illustrator. They've never met trans people. They don't know about trans people.
Right.
And Ray, who's like a DJ and a filmmaker, and is like making these, you know, short videos about his own transition. It's like, you don't seem to have any trans friends. It's like, you're not posting these videos on YouTube and like creating a community for yourself that way. You're not part of a support group in New York City where you live, or online. Like,
at least online.
Yeah, at least.
It's reasonable to think that maybe Ray doesn't know any other trans teenagers IRL.
Maybe.
But
he would absolutely have trans friends online.
On the internet, yes.
Yeah. And also, as we know from I Am Jazz and from anything else I've ever seen about trans teenagers, they've done the homework.
Yes.
They've done the homework. They have the talking points. They have They have the snappy answers to stupid questions, as Mad Magazine used to call them.
Yep.
They are ready to talk about this stuff. And Ray never seems to have, like, he should be, like, giving handouts to the mom and the grandmother and the dad and anybody else. Like, Ray would be more on top of what's happening and the actual scientific ramifications, all that stuff, would have answers at the ready and information at the ready.
It's a poorly written
because there's
film.
This thing called the internet that the teenagers all seem to like a lot.
It's a very frustrating movie. It's very poorly written. It means well.
It's well intentioned.
And here's the thing, in spite of its many, many shortcomings and flaws, it's probably going to help somebody.
Probably, because there is not a ton
there's
of
not
stuff
enough
out there.
But again, let's go back to I Am Jazz. All right. You watch that show, and I really encourage everybody.
You really should.
Watch this show. It begins with, I guess she's going on 14 at the beginning of the show, or she might have just turned 14.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the series.
Because it's now, what, third or fourth season?
Yeah, they're fixing it. They have a third season. She is on point all the time. But it's not just that, okay? She lives in a suburb of some city in Florida.
Yeah.
They live in Florida in a very, very, pardon me, bland, normie, suburb. And her mom, and her dad, and her two brothers, and her older sister.
Even her grandparents.
They are as basic and normal, not particularly culturally sophisticated, not these bohemian artists like in this film, not the folks that you would expect to be, all on board and all knowing how to talk about this and all knowing how to take care of their sister.
Yeah.
And they all do.
Yeah.
They all do. Everybody in this family. We are shown the grandparents as having to be educated on a variety of things.
Yeah. Terminology and whatnot.
But I bet that's for the camera. I bet the grandparents already knew the things that they're pretending not to know.
And giving three generations, some slack, I grant that the I Am Jazz family is not drama. That it's not good drama to have if everybody's already on board and on the same page and all that stuff. Fine. But you got to give me a family that I am believing needs the work.
Yeah.
And the folks that we're getting in this movie just all seem to be...
I don't know why I'm coughing so much right now.
Me neither. All seem to be far too, life literate to be so gobsmacked by this process.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't ring true. And so the timidity of the film leeches into the characters, but you don't believe that they would be so timid about it. And so it just all kind of rings false.
I wish it were better.
Yeah.
It's just not that good.
No. I will say this, it is beautifully shot. And, we're talking before about Lost City of Zed. Here's a movie that's shot in New York City, which we've seen a million times in a million movies, and you can't imagine that you're going to see it any differently. David Johnson, I believe, is the cinematographer, uses natural light in kind of wintry New York in such a gorgeous way, and really captures the way that rooms feel. And it's a lot like, frankly, what they do in The Revenant, without beating you over the head about how impressive it is that they're using natural light. And maybe they didn't use all natural light, but it looks like, it feels like it's all being lit by the sun streaming through the windows, or like on the streets, you know, as Ray goes skateboarding or whatever. I felt like I hadn't seen New York City lit that way in a long time, and it was just spectacular.
It looks good.
Yeah, that's what
this is like, the new thing. This movie's kind of bleh, or this movie's completely offensive, or this movie's terrible, but it looks good. Like, that's our latest thing, I think. You know, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. All right, I had a good time. The end.
I didn't not enjoy myself for the entire running time. Like, I never felt bored by it, or like it dragged, or it was whatever. But at the same time, it didn't feel special the way the first Guardians did. And it kind of felt like...
Because it didn't give you a jump of... It didn't give you a surprise. It didn't come out of the blue, you know, hey, everybody, we're not the normal Marvel movie. We're going to be... funny and goofy and ha cha cha.
So like any sequel, it's really hard to kind of recapture that magic of the first go round.
Uh-huh.
And then plot wise, it just kind of felt like it was sort of dithering a bit to sort of kill time until the next movie. And they throw out a lot of, like, you know, they actually go the we're family route, you know, which, thank you, Vin Diesel. He seems to be taking to all of his franchises now. It didn't always ring true to me. I think some of the emotional payoffs they're going for, I didn't quite buy. And there are a few moments where they're really letting the music, and not like the score, but I mean the pop songs, do the emotional heavy lifting, which kind of bugged me. But so basically, the story is that, you know, the Guardians are back, and at the beginning of the movie, they are defending these giant batteries from alien invaders.
Yes.
Rocket steals a handful of them, and so they're being chased for most of the movie by these, like, golden people who look like ambulatory Oscars. And then,
and who are very funny.
They are.
They're so convinced of their own superiority.
Their own perfection, yeah. Elizabeth Debicki plays their queen, and I like her. She was the one thing I really liked in the Great Gatsby remake. So then they, you know, for a movie that is going to be like, we'll put plot in the background because we're going to, you know, we love these characters. We're going to hang with these characters. Then they divvy them up. So you've got Star-Lord and, Gamora and Drax going off with Kurt Russell, who is Star-Lord's dad.
Yes.
Ego, the Living Planet. And then you've got Rocket and Groot and the imprisoned Nebula staying behind to fix the ship. And they each get into their various scrapes. And, you know, there are a couple of characters from last time who we thought were bad through and through, who maybe get cut some slack this time. And we find out that they meant well, or they have a good person buried inside of them.
Maybe.
Yeah, and then there is, like, I think this might have the most shawarma of any Marvel movie so far.
Let's wait on that for a moment.
No, I'm not going to get into it because, there are so many articles online where people can explain this way better than I can because they're more versed in this stuff. Just Google 5 endings of Guardians 2 and you'll find it, but... I know The Wrap has at least one article explaining all that stuff. But yeah, there's like so much of that stuff. It's like, okay, yes, we get it. More to come, you know. But that said, whatever flaws whatever things that I thought were kind of whatever, I had a good time. And it moves well, and these actors are all fun, and the dialogue is zippy. And, you know, I had a good time watching it. It's just not Guardians 1.
I think I liked it more than you, although apparently we both gave it the same score.
Yes, which I think...
On our various scoring necessities.
Yeah, I think you're just tighter with your numbers than I am. But yeah, I gave it a 75 on Metacritic, and you gave it a 7.5 on What the Flick. But you did like it more than I did.
Yes. This did not feel like an interlocking puzzle piece of a Marvel movie to me.
Okay.
And I'm always a little annoyed by the interlocking puzzle pieces.
Mm-hmm.
I would like the movie to stand by itself.
Yes. Yeah, Iron Man 2
and not just bridge me from one thing to another.
Is infamous for that sort of thing.
This one felt like they... I have a feeling, and I'm probably wrong because I'm wrong about everything. Somebody at the studio said, hey, we're going to bridge blah, blah to blah, blah with this.
Uh-huh.
And they said, nah. We're just going to run around in a circle. And that's kind of what this movie does. It just takes you with these characters on a new adventure
mm-hmm.
that may or may not have future ramifications. Who knows? Who cares?
Right.
But it mostly digs into, do these characters have a reason to be so invested in the idea of being a family?
Mm-hmm.
It does it in a way that is better than any Fast or the Furious movie has accomplished. They say family to the point of nausea in the Fast and the Furious films. This movie doesn't say family, but is in fact about the lingering adult emotional effects of childhood trauma.
Yes. And they say it once.
With most of the... I know, mm-hmm. but they don't say it a lot.
They don't say it 20 times. Yeah, I grant you, yes.
But most of the characters in this film are on some kind of emotional storyline.
Mm-hmm.
Even Rocket, and we don't know exactly what with him. He's the one where there's a little ambiguity going on.
Right.
You know, everybody else has a beginning and a middle and an end here.
Yeah.
In this particular story. So I liked that element of it. I liked how big and loud and noisy and flashy and explodey and colorful it was. Mm. It was funny. Sure, the songs do more work than they should. But the songs were such an integral part of the first film that I think it's inevitable that they're going to be an integral part of this film as well, and I am not too bothered by it.
Well, but I think there's a difference between...
I know.
You know what I'm saying.
I do know what you're saying.
There's one song in particular, I won't say what it is, but when they whipped it out, I'm like,
Intentionally trying to get you to cry.
Yeah, this is Dirty Pool.
Yeah, I know, I know.
And frankly, the Rocket emotional stuff is the stuff that I thought was the most strained.
Interesting. Right.
I just in terms of trying to, it felt like we're trying to wedge this character and through this funnel of feelings to explain something. It's like, I don't need that and I don't buy it, you know. But there's other stuff in the film, and obviously because of, you know, Star-Lord, Peter Quill's daddy issues are made manifest. So that
yes.
makes sense, and I buy that. There's some fun new characters. I like Mantis quite a bit.
Oh, man, do I love Mantis.
She and Drax have a fun chemistry.
Yeah. And she's Canadian.
Yes, and there's Palm...
Clementief?
Clementief.
Clementief? Clementief. She's Quebecois.
That's true.
Maybe so Clementif. We don't know.
Clementif.
It's a kind of French name.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to say it. Sorry. But she is the bright jumping out person in this film for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Every moment with her on screen delighted me.
Mm.
So I'm excited to learn that she's also going to be in Avengers Infinity War.
Well, yeah, I believe we are gearing up to the inevitable Avengers Guardians crossover, which is going to be odd because those films have a certain amount of tone in common, but
yeah.
Seeing the Guardians with like the A-listers is going to be interesting. I don't know how that's
going to work. They're all going to be A-listers in Infinity War. I mean, they are all. Listen, here's the cast. Karen Gillan, Palm Clementif, Chris Pratt, Zoe Saldana, Brie Larson, Vin Diesel, Scarlett Johansson, Dave Bautista, Chris Evans, Chris Hemsworth, Michael Rooker, Robert Downey Jr., Benedict Cumberbatch, Bradley Cooper, Josh Brolin, Sam Jackson, Tessa Thompson, Kobe Smulders, Tom Holland, Elizabeth Olsen, Sebastian Stan, Paul Rudd, Sean Gunn, Jeremy Renner, Peter Dinklage, Benicio Del Toro, Paul Bettany, Mark Ruffalo, Chadwick Boseman, Benedict Wong, Anthony Mackie, and Terry Notary.
So everybody.
Everybody! That movie's going to be 7 hours long.
Well, I think it is.
Directed by Lav Diaz.
Yeah, it's like a two-parter or something. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, Guardians Volume 2, it's fine. It's fine. It's fun. You'll enjoy yourself. I just was a little
I did not stay for the credit bumps.
Then you should go read one of those articles.
I don't feel like it. Here's why. I'm going to tell you why. Two reasons why.
Because you're so cool.
Okay, three reasons why. Number one, I'm so cool. Number two, you weren't with me.
To translate.
And every single time I watch a Marvel movie, after the credit bump, however many there are, one or two, I turn to you and I say, "Splain," because it's always fan service.
Yes.
It's always, ooh, here's a character that we were hiding from you, and now here they come. Yeah. And so I have to turn to you and say, I don't know what that is. What's that? Who's that? What are they holding? What's the thing that just zapped out of someone's forehead? Like, why is Pikachu suddenly in this movie? What's going on?
And half the time I have to turn to our friend Tom and be like, what is this? You know, so.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Really?
For at least two of the five on this one, I was like,
okay. Mm. And so. The third reason for this particular screening is that they took my phone.
Jerks.
Here's what I mean by this. Now, I don't need my phone in a movie. Let's be very clear about that. And I turn off my phone.
And you saw it in 3D, right?
No.
Oh, okay.
I saw it 2D. I turn off my phone before I go to a film.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, even moments before the lights go down, the phone's off. Off! Not just on airplane, not just on vibrate. Off. I'm a good citizen. Here's what happens at press screenings with no other studio except Disney. Disney is the only studio that does this. They literally take your phone away from you and your driver's license, and they put it in a Ziploc bag with a coat check ticket, and they hand you the number ticket, and you have to then, when the film is over, stand in line with 300 other people. And for 30 minutes or longer to wait and get your phone.
And it's just,
and it's insulting.
Like we're doing something about piracy. We're treating critics like criminals.
Yes. It's insulting. And Disney's the only studio that does it.
You know what Disney does at their premieres?
What?
They have this, like, they make you put your phone inside this pouch.
Yes.
Like a cloth bag that has a magnetic clasp on top.
Okay.
So you are holding onto your phone but can't access it for the entire time. And then when the movie's over, they have these tables set up with these like magnets on them that you put the clasp on and it opens and you can take your phone back.
But you still have to wait in a long ass line.
Well, it's not that bad because I mean it's less bad than having to pick up your phone with a coat check thing because they have like six magnets set
up. Okay.
Well, no, you're right.
I resent this.
Yeah, it's terrible.
I'm a 53-year-old professional film critic.
You're not going to jeopardize your career.
I do this for a living. This is my job. I'm not going out to
steal your movie.
Steal Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Okay, so I had to turn in my phone. I had to get my coat check ticket. The minute those credits roll, nobody moves.
Of course.
Because they all know that at least one is coming. They didn't know that five were coming. Neither did I. I just got up. I walk out. I'm the first person at the table. The guy goes, "Is it over?" I said, "It is for me." He goes, "What do you mean?" I go, "Are the credits going?" And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Go back in. There are five different credit moments." I said, "No."
Give
he goes,
me my phone.
"Why not?" He goes, "You took my damn phone."
That's why.
I need my phone. I don't want to wait another 45 minutes in line to get my phone. Someone will explain the credits to me later. It wasn't part of the movie. It's just a little commercial for something coming.
It's what James Rocky calls the anticipation
industrial complex.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. Got my phone first. I'll be doing this from now on.
Yeah,
at all these films.
Somebody, because you don't care, and someone else will tell you. And
I care about the film.
Yes,
I don't care about a thing that you're going to show me that I will not understand anyway.
The vague previews of coming attractions.
Yes, that I need to go to you or Tom.
Yeah,
and say,
explain.
What do I do? What happens? What is this? Explain it all to me.
You tried to make me take this out of my review, but I didn't, where I said that the closing credits had more buttons than a bellhop's uniform.
I didn't try to take you. I didn't try to make you take that out. I said, that's a very you thing to say. You are a very young person with an old-timey brain.
Yeah.
And you think of the buttons on a bellhop's uniform. There are no bellhops. Unless you are at the fanciest of 1947 hotels.
There are on TCM.
Yes, there are. Lots of them on TCM.
Call for Philip Morris.
Paging Mr. Herman.
You do not have a DVD pick?
I don't.
All right. I have a streaming pick. It is on iTunes and other places. Film that I saw at the USA Film Festival that is now available to be seen, and I liked it quite a bit. It's called The Father and the Bear. It is directed by John Putch. His father, for years, ran a regional theater in southern Pennsylvania where his entire family, John and his sister, his mom, who happens to be the actress Edith Stapleton, Jean Stapleton, who played Edith for years on All in the Family, worked at this theater. And so he made a movie there starring one of the actors who performed there for a long time. And he's playing a retired actor who is starting to suffer from dementia.
Yes.
And had sort of walked off stage years ago after forgetting his lines and hadn't been back in a long time. And this guy, one of the DeLuises, I forget who, plays this director who comes in to do this one fundraising show for the summer, casts this guy and sort of gives him one last chance to sort of have a final show there at the theater. And, you know, and because the guy who plays the older actor had done all these shows at that theater, they incorporate all these old home movies and old stills of him having performed there. You know, it's kind of like the Limey with the old footage of Terrence Stamp. And it's just really just simple story, but very beautifully told and, you know, dealing with aging and with, you know, the onset of Alzheimer's and I thought it was really lovely, and I think people should check it out. It's a little movie, not getting a huge amount of attention, but worth checking out. Again, it's called The Father and the Bear, directed by John Putch. It is on iTunes. We'll put a link on the Facebook page.
So, it is time for letters.
Yes, the great letter catch-up that we promised.
What you don't know is that we just took a 30-minute break.
Yes.
So that I could,
For ham.
I poured the glaze on the ham,
mm-hmm.
But I also had to do some prep for other items. I had to wash the collard greens. I had to chop up that smoked turkey leg. Mm. Chop up the onion and the garlic. Get all my collard greens stuff together.
Your aromatics.
I made some dough. For a tart.
Mm-hmm. And if you want more of this kind of captivating conversation about the things that we make and the things that we eat, subscribe to Linoleum Knife and Fork. It's available at patreon.com/linoleumknife. Just one of the many goodies we offer to the people who give us money.
Yeah. You know what? Linoleum Knife and Fork is not bad.
It's working.
For a podcast about food by two film critics, I think it's a pretty... I'm entertained by me.
We don't know food professionally, but, you know.
Experientially.
There you go. We're autodidacts.
Eatishly
mm-hmm.
and cookishly.
Yes.
Which is what we do.
Mouth crammingly.
We've had a guest so far.
Two.
We've had the artist Nayland Blake on to make a frosting poodle.
And food journalist Margie Rockland.
Margie Rockland to tell us about things.
Yeah.
We might have a real chef coming on sometime.
We have a couple
in the near future.
We have a couple of very interesting guests lined up.
They're not lined up yet. They're in the
We're in talks. We have firm commitment though from two people who do very cool things.
Yes, we
in
do.
The food world.
And we have an interest from a real live
yes
fancy chef.
Yes. So
that's
there's
hilarious to me.
I know.
That this person is like, "Oh yes, I would love to come on." You don't know what you just agreed to.
We'll let Fancy Chef do all the talking because we'll just be like, "Goo." But yeah, it's a fun show. Check it out. Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
That's right.
All right, letters.
This is from WTBA. Oh, it's from Eric.
I was going to say, what?
Eric. The subject line, sharing my favorite moments from LK history. To the freewheeling Dave White and the not as freewheeling Alonzo Durante.
oh, if you only know.
Stop that. Reverse it.
Thank you.
This is my second letter, though, thankfully. This one is less of a personal nature. I appreciate you reading my previous letter and look forward to enjoying your reactions to this one. Did we read the previous letter yet? Or have we got those backwards too?
No, yeah. I think we already read his first letter, he says.
I started listening during late 2016 after jumping around to earlier Linoleum Knives. From the last couple of years, I decided to go back to the beginning. I have been working my way forward from the first episode. Dang.
The learning curve.
Thanks, Libsyn. I wanted to give you guys a few of my thoughts and favorite moments from the storied history of Linoleum Knife. Unsurprisingly, the top moments all involve Dave.
Fine. Great.
Confirming his status as champion of Linoleum Knife. I do remember once we had a contest where we were deciding who was the champion.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad that I've won.
No, this is but one vote.
The only person who's voted outside of you and me so far has been Eric.
No, I believe we decided back in the day that it was a tie and we dropped it. But you clearly have never dropped it.
I don't remember this.
Fine.
I only remember me being the champion of Linoleum Knife.
Uh-huh, that's adorable. Gary Cotty is outside, so...
So what?
Is the door open?
Why don't you go get it and I'll keep reading
this.
Okay,
do that.
Just remember, Alonzo, second place is better than no place at all.
Yeah.
Seriously, you guys are both great. Dave just naturally wins every room he enters.
I'm going to be sick. Don't mess with my digestion. I have a ham to eat.
How much drink is in that bag?
Much drink.
Although I enjoy the current theme music... After having gone back to the beginning, I miss that you no longer do the cassette thing. Do not spoil when that changeover happened, though. I am eager to see how it is handled when it arrives as I listen through. Oh, okay.
He hasn't gotten to the transition you haven't yet.
Or the explanation why.
Right.
Okay. My favorite cassette moments were Susan when she tried... And the amplified decapods. The wondrous nature of decapods knows no bounds. As an aside, Susan and the Decapods would be a great band name.
What was Susan when she tried?
I forget. If any listeners are starting bands, feel free to use that name. I also enjoyed Dave's strong feelings about ricotta cheese and lasagna. I was unaware that some people use cottage cheese. Those people should be banned from cooking food and also eating it. Full fat everything is how to do it. For example, whole milk is superior to its lame X percent counterparts. Would you want 2% pizza? If you do, then you get no pizza. Finally, my all-time favorite LK moment so far is Dave's story about the screening with the free cake. That was the big wedding.
Oh, right. Okay,
that was the radio screening of the big wedding.
Yes.
Where they gave out free wedding cake.
Yes.
And the old people went bonkers about it. Who wants to go on a cake run? The best part of this story is Dave's impersonation of the two women crowing, "Start the movie!" I just lost it every time. I often go back to that episode just to hear it all again.
Well, just wait till you get to the Monica Mana screening story.
Oh, yeah. I will end things with a movie question. I recently rewatched one of my favorite creepy movies, Play Misty, for me.
Hmm.
What are your thoughts on this film?
It's been ages since I've seen it. It's, you know, it's sort of the Fatal Attraction school.
Yeah.
You know, Jessica Walter, if you only know her as the mother on Arrested Development, you will be surprised by this era of her career.
Yes. Thanks for reading. Keep on knifing or kniving. Oh, and I just ordered Alonzo's two books and Dave's book two from Amazon, eager for their arrival.
Then I forgive you everything.
Yep. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks.
Letter to Linoleum Knife Podcast from Christopher Robles. Which one is this?
non-donut Christopher Robles.
This is non-donut Christopher Robles.
Yes.
Okay. It'll never stop shocking me that we have two listeners named Christopher Robles.
What are the odds?
I mean, we're not a big podcast.
No.
We are a small potato.
Yeah.
We're a tiny little fingerling potato.
And yet,
two of our listeners.
Two active listeners.
Have the same name. Yeah. Dear Alonzo and Dave, this is Chris R. again. There are a few things I would like to ask you guys that have been bugging me recently. I'm sorry for using a PDF for my letters.
Oh, that's fine.
You guys never said anything about what form the letters should be.
Dave's just clueless about the tech stuff. Don't worry about it.
When you guys were on the B-Movies podcast listing the best films of the decade so far, I was very surprised that Dave didn't put on his list or even mention in his runner-up the documentary Monica Mana.
Hmm.
Dave, how could you forget it? You never shut up about it.
Yeah,
you love
Dave.
It so much. I saw it back when it was on Netflix, and I loved it. I want to know how this happened. Dude, I don't know how it happened.
Lists are dumb.
Lists are stupid. It doesn't matter.
Still, you love that movie so much, you ought to marry it.
I should. I married Monica Mana. My new sitcom.
That would be like...
That's a Chuck Tingle book, actually.
That would be your esoteric drag name.
Monica Mana. Yeah, okay. Back in 2012, Alonzo kept saying at the end of every episode that you guys would knife the 2012 Sight and Sound list. We did.
Oh, did we? We never got around to it.
But for some reason, maybe Dave's mom's death, that never happened. I want you guys' opinion on this list and why Bibbs and Whitney are wrong about 8.5. Well, if Bibbs and Whitney do not like 8.5, Bibbs and Whitney are wrong about 8.5. We could dig up the 2012 yeah. Sight and Sound, I guess.
We'll put that on the to-do list. Sorry, we dropped that ball.
This is a shortened version of my third letter, so if you haven't read that yet, you could read it here, I guess. And that is what you guys... That is, what do you guys think of the Criterion Collection, and what do you think of Filmstruck? The new film streaming service. Well, you're going to find out pretty soon what Alonzo Duralde thinks of Filmstruck, and that's all I'll say. But it's good news.
It is very good news.
And when it's more concrete...
We'll talk about it. But in the short term, we love it.
I'm going to make a short film about the day in the life of a young woman who is also a drug dealer in the next few weeks. Any advice?
Yeah. Come interview our next door neighbor.
Yeah. Allegedly.
Jeez. Hate that guy. Okay, finally, have you seen Samurai Cop? You know what? I have not seen Samurai Cop.
I have not either.
We
I'm
should,
sure
though.
That I know what it is.
We should see it. It's just one of those...
It's like a trauma movie?
I haven't gotten around to it. It's all, you know... I will.
Samurai Cop.
One of these days. There's a million movies that I haven't seen.
I know.
And I feel guilt about that every time.
Oh, come on.
I do.
Give yourself a break.
No.
As Bibbs puts it, it's always good to have things to look forward to.
That's true.
So there you go.
P.S. This letter was originally sent in October, but you guys seem to have lost it. Please fix this problem. This has happened to me twice now. Very sorry.
Sorry, Chris R. We're
terrible.
Yeah, it's
mostly Alonzo's
mostly Dave's fault.
Yeah. Ken says, Dave and Alonzo, Ken here. I wrote to you guys last year. Sent you a top 10 list when I was a high school junior. Not much has changed since then, except I am now a high school senior.
Hooray!
In the last few months,
you may have graduated by now.
He's probably already graduating, like this month, yeah.
Congratulations.
A prospect I find both very exciting and incredibly intimidating. Go watch Ghost World.
It all gets better from here.
You go watch Ghost World, you'll see how important high school graduation is.
This is all a blip, trust me.
I still maintain a movie review blog, filmreviews12.com. Filmreviews12.com. Mm. Although I've recently started contributing to an independent movie website called filmpulse.net, it's great writing for them. There are some great writers and editors there. Also, Film Pulse has way more readers than my blog. You don't have to tell us about trying to jumpstart a personal thing, let me tell you. And I semi-frequently get to review things on screeners, which is nice. That is... Always very nice.
Yeah.
But anyway, I thought I would send you my top 10 list for 2016.
Okay.
There are still a number of big releases from last year that I have not seen, so consider this a work in progress. as all lists tend to be. South Side with you.
Yes.
I Am Not Your Negro.
Yes.
Sing Street.
Yep.
Divinus.
Didn't see it. Heard good things. Yeah, me
neither. 13th.
Mm-hmm.
Wiener.
Yeah.
Mountains May Depart.
Yeah.
The Witch.
Yeah.
Moonlight.
Mm-hmm.
La La Land.
Great. You are 100% knife.
I like your list. You're 100% knife, dude. Dude named Ken. Ken dude. Senior in high school graduating. P.S. I'm writing to you shortly after listening to the February 12th episode in which you discussed Luca Guadagnino's upcoming Call Me By Your Name.
Mm.
I'm currently reading the Andre Ackerman, I can't pronounce his last name, novel on which the film is based, and if the movie is even a fraction as wonderful and poetic as the book, then we're all in for a treat. Every early film festival review seems to indicate that this is so. I'm very excited.
Me too, and I have not seen it yet, but everything I've heard has just been gush, gush, gush.
This is from Garrison.
Mm.
The immensely bearded Garrison.
Yes. Sculpturally, one might say.
How much of a goth do you think So Young Kim is? Since two of her movies share a title with popular songs by The Cure, I would guess that she is at least 40% goth.
Goth yeah. light. Or, you know, a recovering goth.
Here's from Kevin. Hey, guys. Recent fan of the show.
Thank you.
Found the podcast through What the Flick.
Yay.
Apologies for the ambiguous as hell subject line. Well, it's not ambiguous to me, but it's going to be ambiguous to most of our listeners. Here's the subject line of the email. Mysterious United Artists 8 Movie Mall in North Dallas.
I remember it well.
Okay, so in the episode from June 26th, which I assume was last 2016, okay. In which you review Independence Day Resurgence, I still haven't seen it, woe is me, you guys mentioned a United Artists 8 movie theater that you dubbed the Movie Mall. To my knowledge, there might be one UA movie theater, a dying breed, in Garland, and one in Fort Worth. Now, if you're talking about the United Artists North Star 8...
The one that we were talking about.
The one that we were talking about was the UA... I guess it was
just called the United Artists
Theater. United Artists Theater. This was on Central Expressway in North Dallas.
Between Carruth Haven and Park like, Lane.
Around the Walnut Lane area.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. I don't know if it's torn down. I don't know if it's something else now, but it is no longer
the movie.
It was literally a mini mall.
It was,
that was never anything except a movie theater up top
yeah.
and stores that never stayed open for more than a month underneath.
The way the building was structured was the yeah. box office was downstairs, you took a giant escalator, and there were 8 theaters upstairs. But downstairs, there were like restaurant spaces and retail spaces, and nothing ever lasted there. Like they had laser tag, they had a nightclub that lasted for one day until yeah. they realized that it bled into the theaters, yeah. and so they shut it down.
Right.
There was a Chinese restaurant for a while, there was...
There was an arcade. Did you mention that part?
The laser tag, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, everything failed in that space. But and they may well have just torn the whole thing down. But it was, they tore down part of the shopping plaza at Carruth Haven. Because remember, there used to be yes. a little tiny, like,
yep.
2 or 3 screen theater there.
Yeah.
And in this giant space between Carruth Haven and, like, yeah, Walnut Hill Park Lane, that area, they
right.
built this freestanding monstrosity that did not last, and I guess maybe it's just now.
Well, it lasted for the entire time I lived in Dallas,
yes.
which was about 18 years.
Yeah,
it was there almost, right, basically the whole time, I think.
Huh.
Anyway.
It was not there when I moved there in 1989.
It doesn't matter.
Anyway, it's history now. So that's why you can't find it. I think they probably just tore it down.
But if you were talking about the United Artists North Star 8 in Garland, Texas, on Beltline Road, I used to go to that one all the time because I lived a 5-minute walk away with my family in Garland at that time. Yeah, this was in the early to mid-1980s.
Right. So we hope that.
Thank you, Kevin.
Solves the mystery for you.
It might or might not. This is from Daniel. Hey, Alonzo and Dave. I think one of the more interesting things to come out of the La La Land controversies is all the people who don't listen to, don't like jazz, and have never set foot in a jazz club, yet have risen up to condemn its representation in this movie.
Indeed.
I do love jazz, especially live shows, and have to tell you that jazz is integrated. It has been since the 1940s. Anyway, I love the show and the absurdities of life, Daniel.
Thank you. Yes, white people aren't allowed to have opinions about jazz or like it or defend it or be enthusiastic about it.
Ever. I don't think they should. I don't think white people should have any opinions about this. I'm a hardliner.
Yeah, because you're such a jazzbo.
All the white people should just stop talking for the rest of their lives, including us. This is the end of the podcast. I'm sick of us. Sick of everybody.
What else we got?
This is from Miriam. Okay. The letter begins with an asterisk that says, spoilers for Get Out.
I think we can...
Asterisk, like probably important spoilers, not just basic spoilers.
Do we think enough time has passed that we can talk about Get Out with impunity?
It's been a few months.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Look, fast forward like 2 minutes.
Two minutes.
You really don't want
to
hear this.
60 to 120 seconds. Yes. She says, you guys, I think I figured out the real reason Allison Williams picked the fight with the cop over the ID. She didn't want to leave an evidence trail that our hero had actually been with her before he disappeared. It came to me last night as I was falling asleep. Then I forgot about it. Then I just remembered.
That is a very good observation.
Yeah,
I believe you are right.
Yep. Yeah, it's probably true.
Yes.
Timmy.
Hello,
gents. I was watching the Soup Nazi episode of Seinfeld, and I've picked up on Jerry and his girlfriend insufferably calling each other Schmoopy as a pet name. Both of you have used this word to refer to a movie that is either precious or cutesy in its approach. Is Seinfeld the genesis of this term?
Not for me.
Well, if it is, it's convoluted, and I don't think about it as the origin of that
word.
It's
just a word that sort of floated around.
It's
I'm sure there's a grammatical term for this, but it is a word that accuses something of being a thing while itself being that thing.
Oh my God.
What?
Okay. This is from Brent.
Mm-hmm.
Dear David Alonso, after hearing the story of Dave's career in, quote, gentleman's special interest cinema, do we call it a career?
It was a fling.
It was a one-year period of my life in the year 2003 when I was in between jobs and two gay porn directors that I know here in Los Angeles said to me, would you like to be a production assistant on a variety of shoots? And over the next year, I was a production assistant on approximately 6 different titles.
Okay.
My job was go get lunch, clean up stuff, hold the fill light if I need you, move a box, bring a couple apple boxes for this short porn star, give them their Viagra, make sure they take it. What else?
Drive the one guy to the doctor to get the injection.
Drive the one guy to the doctor, drive the other guy back to his hotel, drive the other guy to his next appointment. That was basically my gig. Like, I just would stand there and...
Right.
Wait for the director to say, I need you to go blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And occasionally, my favorite of the two directors would stand off to the side near the monitor, and occasionally during directing, which involved him sitting in a chair and saying, it's so hot. He would turn to me and he'd say, isn't it hot, Dave? And I'd say, uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, it's hot. So bored. No, it was not hot. It was just boring. But it was a fascinating gig.
Yeah.
Anyway, he continues, I tracked down and, let's say, acquired a copy of the film Muscle Penitentiary.
Ah, that classic.
Upon viewing, I did not come across the scene containing Dave's arm.
Playing the dead warden.
I was pressed into service to be in the film. Film. We'll call it a film. I was pressed into service to be in the film, but only my arm. You saw only my arm, and my arm was to represent the dead prison warden that the inmates had killed so that they could take over the prison and turn it into their own sexual pleasure center. All right, so I wrote about this experience in a literary journal called Slake about 5 years ago.
Yes, there's an article called My Arm the Porn Star.
The article is actually called My Arm the Porn Star. If you go to Amazon, you can buy that copy of Slake, S-L-A-K-E.
Mm-hmm. First issue, I believe.
First issue they ever did. Blue cover, I think. And anyway, upon viewing, I did not come across the scene containing Dave's arm. Though, to be fair, I was watching it at four times the speed. Smart. So I may have blinked and missed it. I did see that he got a credit. I did. I got a screen credit. And he attached the screenshot. Now, we cannot share this screenshot with anyone other than private friends because the screenshot is of two naked dudes doing a sex thing to each other. But underneath, in big blue letters, underneath them doing the sex thing, it says, Production Assistant Dave White. and the editor friend, I mean, the director friend said, do you want a different name? Do you want a porn assistant name? And I said, who cares? Literally, who cares? Because you can put my name on this, and it could be one of any of the millions of Dave Whites that exist
Dave
in the world.
Dave White is the name that somebody changes their name to when they want to be anonymous.
Yeah. So anyway, here's the screenshot. Hilarious.
That's great.
I'm moving it out of the email and onto my desktop so I can use it as wallpaper.
Thank you for finding
that. Thank you, Brent. And here is one more letter from Tony, my opera teacher. Well, one of my opera teachers. Mm-hmm. Among my many fabulous traits,
well,
English teacher, gay husband, father, and Dave's opera tutor, one of my other roles is as a freelance writer for a fairly well-known website that focuses on awards punditry.
Uh-huh. Go on.
That guy hates me so much. Not Tony. I'll say it differently. If he remembers me at all, it is as a thorn in his side, a rock in his shoe, and someone he studiously avoided any contact with after my 1 year of participating.
Oh, wow.
Which is fine, because I didn't want to do it. Movies.com made me.
Right.
I didn't want to do it.
I know.
After the absolute shocking cluster effery of the Best Picture presentation, what has gotten lost in the discussion is how Moonlight won. The answer is both simple and complicated. The complicated part of the answer involves the way that Best Picture is chosen. In every other category, it's a simple whomever gets the most votes wins. But in Best Picture, they use a preferential ballot, which involves a counting process that I won't go into. Simply put, though La La Land had its fans, there were others that just didn't like it. Some people ranked it first or second on their ballot, but there likely were voters who ranked it much lower. Moonlight, however, is universally loved, so it is likely that more voters consistently ranked it higher on their ballot.
Right. So, like, if there's seven nominees, you have to send in a ranking of seven, so the top one gets 7 points and the lower one gets 1 point.
My only regret is that we didn't get to see and hear the glorious reaction of the audience to seeing one of the great upsets in the Best Picture category. And now, because I can, here is my 10 best of 2016 for knifing. We'll start with number 10 and go to 1.
Okay.
The Jungle Book.
Okay.
Other People.
Yeah.
13th.
Yeah.
Zootopia.
Okay.
Green Room.
Didn't see it, but I hear it's good.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Manchester by the Sea.
Bleh.
Parenthetically, he writes, hush, Alonzo.
It's my show.
Bleh,
I say.
La La Land.
Okay.
Arrival.
Mm-hmm.
Moonlight.
Okay.
Number 1, Hell or High Water.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're 95% knife, Tony.
You are.
Because Alonzo's not ever going to give you Manchester by the Sea.
I am not.
Signed, Tony, the official opera queen of Linoleum Knife.
Well, congratulations.
Get in line, dude.
Is that it?
The end.
All right, cool. Well, listen, thank you as always for listening, you guys. And as we've mentioned, if you want other stuff from us, our LKTV, Linoleum Knife and Fork, and whatnot.
You'll get nothing like it.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife. And speaking of Patreon, our good friends Bibbs and Whitney are about to kick one off for Canceled Too Soon. And I'm going to be on their next episode talking about all 30 episodes of the one season of My Mother the Car. Which took some doing to get through it, but I did, and we shared our wounds together on their show. Anyway, so while you're at Patreon, go check out Canceled Too Soon and what they're offering, and, you know, maybe help them out if you can. They do a great show, and they're always a lot of fun, too.
I made them a cake.
Yes, Dave made them an anniversary cake. Cause the
Go to my Instagram, you'll see it, D. Leland White.
Canceled Too Soon just hit its first birthday. So yeah, thank you, Blue, for our theme music. Go check out all of our friends on the internet who we always tell you to go check out.
And you will check them out.
And you will. And follow us on Facebook.
Feeling real pushy today.
Instagram and Twitter, at LinoleumCast. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Hey, we've still got those amazing t-shirts.
Yeah, we do.
Even if you aren't a Patreon member, but you want something that says, hey, I listened to this show that you've never heard of, get one of our awesome Linoleum Knife shirts.
$22
$22. More if you're outside the U.S. And if you are, email us first and we'll tell you how much extra for postage. But otherwise, you can just PayPal us directly at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Let us know what size you want. We have them all, including the women's sizes. And tell us where we're sending it. And you can go to linoleum-knife.com to see other stuff that we're up to and links to reviews that we have in other places. And we will catch you next time. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Goodbye.